But I think it's really promising and it's very exciting, and so I'd like to tell you about it. So I hope that you won't harass me too much as I go on about things that are a little vague. Certainly, I am more of a high energy theorist, and I'm going to talk to you a lot about information theory and a little bit about tensor networks and condensed matter. And so I am going to be very vague and unorthodox in those descriptions. So please allow me some leeway as I do that. And so what I'd really like to explain to you is that how we can think of space-time geometry as really being all about some very special iterative compression algorithm. And in some sense, that's really the whole role of space-time, that all of that space-time is doing is computing for us a very beautiful compression algorithm. In order to do that, though, to sort of introduce this idea, I'd like to take a very high-level picture first, because I think this is part of a long ongoing debate about what quantum gravity is all about. So let's be very broad for a moment. And I'd like to talk about quantum gravity really in two different languages. The first language that I'd like to talk about quantum gravity is something that's very coarse-grained. It's about quantum gravity as an effective field theory. And the second language is really about some sort of microscopic unitary quantum field theory. So these are two standard languages we're very used to. We're used to talking about low-energy effective field theories and unitary sort of complete quantum theories. We're also very used to talking about sort of a coarse-grained effective theory as being the bulk in the ADS-CFT duality, and it's ultimately described by the CFT as some unitary complete quantum theory. But I'd like to recast this debate, these two different pictures, in terms of different language. And so I'd like to call the first of these pictures really the idea that gravity is entropic. And this is maybe a little bit more speculative and wild, but it's also the sort of idea amongst the two that has sort of the most distinguished pedigree of thought. So although it's very contrarian, it's very, I think, been enticing to a lot of people. So it's an idea that goes back to black hole thermodynamics of Bekenstein and Hawking, to Einstein's equations viewed as some equation of state by Jacobson. Verlinde's talked about, and you know, gravity is some entropic force. And then sort of in our modern era of ADS-CFT, there's been lots of talk about extremal surfaces and entanglement entropy, about ADS geometry really being about some Mera entanglement network. People have talked about some idea that goes under the moniker ER equals EPR, where entanglement is all about wormholes. And so this is sort of a long intellectual tradition of viewing gravity as something that's fundamentally entropic. So it cares, space-time really seems to care about what things are entangled with, but is very agnostic, at least, about what they're actually entangled with. So it doesn't really matter what the purification of those systems are. And the other standpoint is maybe very conventional, but I think has been given less thought over the years. People have been less enticed by it. And this perspective, really the microscopic structure of the entanglement purification is ultimately important. So in ADS-CFT, we learned that quantum gravity really is described by something that's unitary. And when people look at sort of effective field theory and curved space-time, they talk about the vacuum state. And that vacuum state is not just a state with a particular entanglement structure. It is a particular entangled state. And the same can go for the ADS black hole. At least to the best of our understanding, the eternal ADS black hole is described by the particular thermal field double state and not any other state that shares its entanglement structure. And so the question I really want to ask, and I think that should sort of frame this whole discussion, is which of these two perspectives is correct? Or is there some middle ground between them? So this is not just a question about, you know, quantum gravity at very high scales. So the black hole information paradox has told us that we have to, you know, we're faced to decide between these two perspectives at very large scales. So the reliance on effective field theory and the belief that the vacuum has some fixed structure inevitably leads us to the conclusion there are firewalls at the horizon of a black hole. So the smooth vacuum state requires that fields are entangled in the sort of local Rindler state at the horizon. And there's a particular entanglement structure between the ingoing and outgoing Hawking partners. But on the other hand, we know from the CFT that unitarity requires that, in fact, the outgoing Hawking radiation is entangled with something not what appears to be inside the horizon, but something very far away, some non-local state in the faraway outgoing early Hawking radiation. And so the incompatibility of these mutual entanglements that leads to the firewall can really only be resolved if one tracks and cares about the entanglement, but does not get so hung up on what's actually purifying it. And so this entropic approach to building smooth geometries by constructing the interior Hawking modes from whatever it happens to be that the exterior Hawking modes are entangled with, it's a perspective that leads to proposals like that of Papadimos and Raju, where they build sort of non-linear state-dependent operators to construct the interior of the black hole, and proposals like that of Maldacena and Susskind, that of EPR equals ER, where we get this picture of wormholes encoding the entanglement between degrees of freedom. So what I'd like to tell you is that black holes, I think, are an invaluable pressure test for ideas about quantum gravity, but nevertheless, they also add to the confusion about what we're doing. And I want to say to you today that life is confusing enough without immediately confronting whether quantum gravity can accommodate at least an interpretation of quantum mechanics that violates our ideas of, standard ideas of linear operators making measurements and observables. So while the firewall paradox may drive to the heart of the issues, I think something can be learned by less invasive surgery of the types of things we know. And so what I want to talk about today is exploring this tension between entropy and purity in the absence of black holes, and seeing how much we can really learn about quantum gravity without sort of turning immediately to understanding the black hole information paradox. So the types of questions that we'd like to answer, well, one is, what states have good geometric duals? And if they have good geometric duals, to what extent is this geometry determined by entropic quantities in the CFT? And what is the sort of total amount of information about the CFT and the CFT state we need to know in order to build the geometry? We'd also like to know, is there an entropic interpretation of the holographic RG and the emergence of the radial direction? And we'd like to know, what is the entropic meaning of areas or regions of spacetime? So what is this entropy actually counting? So I hope by the end of today you'll be convinced that what I've described to you, I think, is substantive progress towards answering all three of these questions. But these questions are actually, I think, very broad. I think you agree they're very high level. And so I'd like to recast these three questions into something a little more specific. So I'd like to tell you where I'd like to start in this story. And where I'd like to start is just sort of thinking about this very old story of Bekenstein and Hawking, that we should assign an entropy to the area of black holes or killing horizons that given by their area. The natural thing to ask when one learns this fact is, well, if we can associate an entropy to the area of a black hole, can we associate this notion of entropy to any choice of area in some bulk geometry? And so I think this was sort of framed most nicely in a conjecture by Bianchi and Myers, where they said that, in a theory of quantum gravity, at least for large enough regions of smooth space-times, that the entanglement entropy between degrees of freedom describing the interior of that region and the degrees of freedom describing the exterior of that region should be given exactly, at least a leading order, by this area entropy. So this idea, of course, is very naturally described by the Ryu Takanagi proposal, where we have a very clear understanding of what the degrees of freedom are that describe the interior and what the degrees of freedom are that describe the exterior. And the minimal area really is just the entanglement entropy. But what about everything else? What about in all these scenarios when we don't really understand what are the degrees of freedom of the interior and what are the degrees of freedom of the exterior? And so in order to get some understanding of where we'd like to begin on this story, I think we should take hints from condensed matter theorists and we should look at the Mara network. So for a CFT, it's believed that one can efficiently represent certain low energy states by a network of unitary operators. This network of unitary operators takes a very particular form in terms of its skeleton. And Brian Swingle has suggested that the structure of this lattice for the vacuum state of a CFT really mimics the ADS geometry. So in some sense that this Mara network is encoding bulk geometry. So lattice points deeper into the bulk encode IR entanglement of the CFT. So this is sort of a hint at the answer to question two in terms of the RG. And what's interesting is what happens when we cut out some region of the interior, when we sort of remove these degrees of freedom? Well, we remove a number of unitary operators from the network, and the number of unitary operators we remove is really proportional to the area of the cut. And so the number of possible states that we can get by filling in that interior region again with all possible choices is also proportional to the area of cut. So it seems actually that the Mara is really answering this question three about what we're counting when we talk about the entropy that we should associate to an area of spacetime. It's the entropy that counts all the different states we can get by, preparing the interior in different ways. It's worth noting just immediately that this subspace of states that we get by preparing different states by filling in the interior is not necessarily a tensor factor of the Hilbert space. So it's an immediate suggestion that we shouldn't necessarily be talking about this entropy as an entanglement entropy and thinking about tensor factors of Hilbert spaces. So this is a very nice story for the ground state, but we want to know what is the general story. So how do we build something like the Mara network for any geometric state in the CFT? So this sort of motivates me to give you a series of refined questions. And these are the questions that I'm actually going to answer in the talk instead of those very high-level ones. So I want to answer the question, what is the analog of the Mara network for non-vacuum states? What are the rules for building this right type of network? So there's many different networks you could build. You know, you can just take very sort of simple network structures like matrix product states, and you can create many, many states if the tensors themselves are large enough. So we want to know what are the rules to build an efficient network? And how does that encode geometry? And we want to know, for states that maybe are not geometric, what are the conditions that the network we've built actually has, corresponds to a geometric dual? We'd like to understand how we interpret the holographic RG in terms of operations on this tensor network. And we'd like to understand what is the entropic meaning of subregions of this tensor network. So what is this entropy actually counting? And I'd like to add just a last question that wasn't in the other series of three questions. How do we translate between this very discrete tensor network language and some continuum language that might be more appropriate to continuum quantum field theory? So my plan of attack for doing this begins with a little bit of dithering, and which we've sort of completed now, so we're moving on to things more substantial. First, what I'd like to describe is just remind you of the story of differential entropy, which is one sort of continuum way of assigning an entropy to a region of space-time. And I'd like to tell you how differential entropy naturally leads us through the mathematical field of integral geometry to constructing a kinematic space, so an integral transform of our geometry. And then what I'd like to do is a little basket weaving 101. Maybe somebody took it in undergrad. So I'm going to tell you how we take things we've learned about kinematic space and tell you really how to weave together a tensor network to build a smooth geometric state. And then lastly, when I'm way over time, I will then rush through implications, open questions, and some loose ends in the story I'm telling you. So I hope you will indulge me in taking some time to go through that. So first, from differential entropy to kinematic space. So differential entropy is a continuum analog of the procedure I just described to you of assigning an entropy to a length in the Mara. I'm going to say length here instead of area because everything I'm going to tell you from now on for the rest of the talk is just for 2+1 dimensional bulks. And I'm going to be talking about spatial geometry, so we're always going to be assuming that we have some static slice in a time-independent geometry. So the first sort of idea that goes into differential entropy is rather unexciting. And really, says we should rewrite the integral for the length of some boundary of some region in space-time just in terms of its tangent vectors. This is not a very exciting thing to do, but what's interesting is that we can do a non-local transformation that goes from the tangent space to the space of boundary-anchored geodesics that those tangents lie on. So we convert those tangent vectors into complete geodesics. And just note, for the rest of this talk in here, I'm always going to talk about these geodesics labeled by their left and right endpoints, which I label by U and V. And so for geometries that are boundary rigid, boundary rigid essentially just means that these geodesics we get by extrapolating the tangent space to the boundary are always minimal for their boundary endpoints. So these are never sort of long geodesics that share the same endpoints as some shorter one. So in these geometries, Rutak and Nagy tell us that their length is always computed by the entanglement entropy of that boundary region that they subtend. And so the integral that we get that computes this area miraculously just takes this very simple form. So the conversion from the local tangent space in terms of variables on the boundary is actually not complicated at all. That is just an integral of the variation of the entropy with respect to its boundary endpoint. And so you should really understand what this differential entropy is. It's just really, as I think Rob showed us very clearly, is that this is really just sort of the Hamilton-Jacobi theory for these geodesics up to some boundary term that cancels when this is a closed geodesic. So what do these computations look like? It's nice to get a picture of what the picture is when we're computing differential entropy, because I'm going to convert these into something a little different later on. So just to build a little bit of intuition, imagine we took just this blue circle in spacetime, and then we looked at all of the boundary anchored geodesics that were tangent to it. And so this gives us just an integral over this line in the space of geodesics. And so that's the line in which we compute the differential entropy. If we do something a little more complicated, say we take a non-convex curve, we actually find that it has cusps. So when you're integrating along and you take the tangent geodesics, you find that you actually are going in one direction, that their right endpoint is moving farther along, and then all of a sudden you have to reverse to stay tangent. So you get this cuspy type behavior. And so just remember these two pictures because they're going to come back in a short moment. I also want to tell you that the convex hull of this surface actually has a very simple form in terms of differential entropy, and it's just given sort of by the point-wise minimum of the curve that you drew out for the non-convex surface. So what about integral geometry? So the transformation from the local tangent space to the space of geodesics is exactly the concern of a field of mathematics called integral geometry. Although I should note that some mathematicians certainly view integral geometry really as a theory about symmetric spaces, but I'm going to be using it in sort of a wider context. It really is going to apply to geometries that have no nice symmetric properties. So there's two classic results of integral geometry. The first sort of classic result that you may have heard of is the Radon transform, and you may know its complex analog in terms of twisters and the Penrose transform. So this is an idea that has already showed up in terms of looking at bulk geometry and work of Aguri et al. And Van Ransdonk et al. And so this is just the idea that if we take any function that is compactly supported and continuous, then we can do a Radon transform where we have a new function on the space of geodesics or the space of lines in the Euclidean plane. And it's just found by integrating that real space function over the given line. So that's the Radon transform. But there's another sort of classic result of integral geometry that has not yet been imported into this field, and that's the one I'd like to import today, and that's the Crofton formula. So what is the Crofton formula? It's an interesting way of rewriting the length of a curve. It's sort of related to a field of geometric probability theory that says that a length of curve is really related to the probability that if you the probability that a random geodesic or a random line drawn in the plane will intersect that curve. And so it says that the length of a curve is just given by the an integral over the space of all lines with an appropriate symmetric measure and the number of times that that line intersects the curve. So this is an interesting way of writing the length of a line. The Radon transform and the Crofton formula actually have natural extensions to hyperbolic space. And this is just because, as I said earlier, it's uniquely determined by the symmetry. So it's very simple. So if we let gamma be the space of planes in H2 with the unique invariant measure, then it's again just simply true that the length of any curve in H2 is given by the number of intersections with every geodesic integrated with some appropriate invariant measure, which is fixed up to some constant. So very interestingly, the invariant Crofton measure on the space of planes is given by this. And it's natural to try to assign some geometric meaning to this space of geodesics and some geometric meaning to this Crofton measure. And so we can do this. We can take the Crofton measure to be some curvature density. And if we do that, we find actually that kinematic space is exactly just Lorentzian de Sitter space. So there's a beautiful geometry to this picture. You might ask, why did I go from a Riemannian metric to a Lorentzian metric? What is the meaning of this causal structure? If I get some Lorentzian metric, I should be able to tell you what the causal structure is all about. It's actually quite simple. So what does it mean for two points in the space to be time-like? Well, time-like just means that the one interval, so I should maybe mention I didn't say before, is that this space, you see that alpha goes all the way, the half interval size of the region that this geodesic subtends, goes all the way from 0 to pi. And so we're really counting every geodesic twice. We're counting them with orientation. And counting with orientation really means that every geodesic we can assign some boundary region it subtends. So this geodesic is subtending this region as opposed to its complement on the circular boundary. And so time-like means one's contained in the other. This is actually very nice. if you read the time direction actually is going down, you know, things that are time-like are accessible, and they're accessible because you can get from one to the other just by tracing out. So that's a very sort of simple meaning of what time-like is. You might get into this at points that are light-like separated. So this lies on its light cone. It's very simple. They share a boundary endpoint. Those are light-like separated. And space-like, as you might expect, means that the one interval is not contained in the other. And so this is a kind of, you know, things that are space-like, they're causally inaccessible to you, and that's kind of natural too. If you have the density matrix for this, you know, the density matrix for this region is sort of inaccessible to you. And so that's sort of what you should interpret this sort of space-like, time-like difference to mean. So there's a very, you know, beautiful notion to what the causal structure of dual space is. And so what we've done, and I think has not been done in the mathematical literature, is to use this causal structure in order to find a Crofton formula for more general metrics. So, you know, without symmetry, we might have thought we were lost, and I think that was certainly the viewpoint of some mathematicians, but there really is something we can do. And this causal structure is kind of the bootstrap that allows ourselves to get there. And so the natural Crofton form that reproduces the length of any curve there is a natural Crofton formula that allows us to reproduce the length of any curve in any geometry whose tangent space is sort of completely covered by boundary-anchored geodesics. So what I mean is you could look at a local tangent space and then you could look at the geodesic that lies on, but it might not be one of the ones that are in our space. It might not be one of the minimal geodesics that lies on the boundary. And then we're not able to reconstruct that space. So this is sort of a slight narrowing of the types of geometries, at least using the present tools that we're able to talk about. Although I think there is a natural extension to the kinematic space that includes these long geodesics. So the Crofton measure on this space is given just by du dv, u and v again are these endpoints of the interval, of the length of this minimal boundary geodesic, which we can think of as just the entropy for later purposes. So it's natural to interpret this density as the curvature, so it's just the dv times the curvature, and this is the curvature form of some asymptotically de Sitter Lorentzian metric on the cylinder. So we now have two seemingly different formulas for computing the length of curves. The first was differential entropy, and differential entropy was just sort of told us we should integrate over just all of those geodesics that were only tangent to it. And the Crofton formula was told us we had to integrate over all of the intersecting geodesics, so any geodesic that crossed that surface. So maybe this is, you'd expect this, but it's true. These formulas are in fact the same. There's really only one way to do anything. Differential entropy is really just the partially integrated form of the Crofton formula. So you essentially just do one of the integrals. You integrate, say, over dv, and you get this integral just of du of the length. And you'll see that this is the exact same integrand as we had in differential entropy. So let's go back to these nice pictures that I was drawing for you before. So we said before that the integral that calculated the length of some circle was just this very simple line. In the kinematic space picture, we add all these other geodesics that cross it, and the ones that cross it kind of continue all the way till we reach the sort of the similar geodesic on the other side, but with opposite orientation. And so it's just the integral over this entire region from alpha here to its opposite oriented surface on the other side, and each time with intersection number 2. It's very simple. And it should be clear that differential entropy is really just these boundary terms that you got from doing this integral. What about this non-convex surface? Well, what you find actually is that you have to integrate not just with intersection number 2, but you now have geodesics that cross with intersection number, say, 4, or multiple times. So what you get is some integral that looks like this. You can see where the cusps actually came from now, that these dark regions actually correspond to geodesics like this one here that enter 4 times. And so this integrating over this additional piece with an extra intersection number 2 is, you know, counted just by doing this integral that appeared to go forward and backward in the differential entropy picture. And so it's very easy to kind of see in this picture that if you take some non-convex surface and you want to make it convex, all you do is count every geodesic with intersection number 2. So that immediately gives you this picture, and you have closed off this geodesics into its convex hull. It's So it closed off the surface into its convex hull. So actually, I think kinematic space makes this picture of differential entropy actually a lot simpler and a lot more intuitive. And so it really is sort of, I think, a natural setting for talking about differential entropy. You might have asked, oh, well, look, so we integrated over this region with intersection number 2. Is it true that I can just integrate over any area in kinematic space with intersection number 2 and find some, you know, well-defined curve? That's actually not true. So a generic region of kinematic space will actually create a curve with both positive and negative pieces in real space. So, you know, I take some blob of kinematic space and I look at the curve it creates, and it will have some lengths that it counts positively and some lengths that it counts negatively. So this is sort of the generic behavior of regions of kinematic space. And this property on the previous slide is something very special. So we need to make a choice. Just to say very briefly, that choice actually is that this region has to be composed of just sort of curves that are associated to points. So if you think about a point in real space, and then you think about the curve of all the geodesics that intersect that point, we could call that a point curve. And if you think about a positive area is just an assemblage of points. And so if you take an assemblage of points over here, you get an assemblage of all of these curves. And so some region of kinematic space that is just a union of point curves gives you a well-defined curve. And I'll come back to this sort of at the very end of my talk, because I think there's actually a very interesting thing that comes as a consequence of that. So that's all I want to say about kinematic space for the moment. We're doing pretty good. So I'd like to talk to you now a little bit more about MERA. And I'd like to try to extract a few more lessons than we did very briefly in the introduction. So let's sort of look at MERA in a little more detail. MERA is a variational ansatz for solving for the ground state of a CFT on some spatial lattice. It is particular tensor network sort of skeleton type, which is sequentially composed of two distinct types of tensor nodes. So these tensor nodes prepare a state from a product state by these two different operations. So here you see these orange squares and blue triangles. So the first operation that happens is that there is a removal of entanglement by these nodes that we call disentanglers. And then there's another operation, which is a coarse graining step, which is conducted by these isometries. And so it's the combination of these two steps that convert the ground state of the CFT here in the UV to just a product, you know, a fiducial product state in the infrared. And so this is sort of the basic mechanics of how MERA works. So I think it's probably very clear to say that MERA geometrizes the structure of entanglement in these states by organizing it into this lattice. But I think it was very beautifully recognized by Swingle and worked on by as well by people here, by Evan Blee and Vidal, that the MERA network has this additional spatial direction to the boundary state. And this spatial direction really is related to the length scale of entanglement coarse graining. And if these two facts are true, that we have an extra length scale that corresponds to some sort of renormalization property, then there really should be an association between MERA and holographic geometry. And so this idea can actually be made very precise. So one can look at the MERA lattice, and we can associate some sort of fixed distance in this lattice to crossing each line. And if we choose coordinates z, which is given just by the log of the length scale along the boundary, then the metric we get from crossing, the discrete metric, its continuum analog, is exactly just the spatial slice of De Sitter space. So it seems like there is this beautiful, perfect agreement between the MERA lattice and anti-De Sitter space. One can actually do a lot more with this picture. So if we do decide to view MERA as this discretized ADS2 geometry, then we find that it also realizes the Ryu-Takanagi procedure for calculating entanglement entropies. How does this work? Well, we can consider some sort of minimal cut in the MERA network that is homologous to some boundary region of length L, as we sort of minimal in terms of measured in terms of lattice lines we cross. So here's our minimal region. And if we look at the number of lattice lines we cross, we see that these actually scale as log of the length. And so what we can do then is we can look at the IR density matrix that we get on the boundary of this region. And it's this density matrix here plus these isometries and unitaries in this interior region, which are the only data necessary to prepare the state on this region of the lattice. And so we see that this IR Hilbert space that encodes all of the entanglement with the exterior, you know, with the other part of the network, has some size, which is just goes like log of the length. And so this gives an upper bound on the possible entanglement entropy of this region, which is very, you know, interestingly saturated for the ground state. So this wouldn't be very interesting if it was just an upper bound. What's very interesting is that the actual entropy saturates this upper bound. And so we really can just count cuts in this network. So this is very beautiful. But there's not everything is perfect. Not everything, I think, works as well as this sort of standard Ryu Takanagi picture. And so I'd like to tell you about two of them. And the first one is that in assigning a metric to the Mara network, we just assumed a Euclidean signature. But there was nothing that sort of derived. Nothing made that necessary. And so I think that we can actually assign a very natural causal structure to this network. And I think that causal structure is suggestive not so much of Euclidean signature, but of Lorentzian signature. So how do we see this? Well, consider some boundary region. We can look at what's called its causal cone. So this is all of the tensors in the network that have some effect on this region. So anything out here can only affect its complement. Changing this node will never have any effect on the density matrix for these sites. But it's also something, I think it's gone by other names, but I'm just going to call it the exclusive causal cone because that's what I've always called it and I can't do otherwise. And this is the sites in the network that only affect this region, that they have no effect elsewhere. So these are all the sites that affect this region, and these are the ones that exclusively affect this region. And so it's very natural to interpret these causal cones as just being sort of outward going and inward going light rays. So I think this is a very natural causal structure. It even has sort of some causal meaning in terms of this network. So why isn't that obvious in the picture of this as just a spatial anti-de Sitter slice? The second problem I'd like to suggest is that a particular node in the network, when we view it as some sort of unitary transformation that affects a region, it really affects some region of a certain size. So we could look at some node here, and it affects this region here. But the particular fact that allows us to associate some transformation on the state here to some region here is the fact that it's a transformation that can't be written as something just on this sort of subregion or this subregion. So it's uniquely defined as some transformation that affects this region, but cannot be written as a transformation that only affects smaller regions. And so it seems more natural to associate this site not with some sort of lump of geometry here, but rather with some sort of narrow strip of geometry along the whole Ryu Takanagi surface. Because there's nothing really distinguished about this point here. These are sort of all equally generic under some symmetry transformation in terms of some region inside this Ryu Takanagi surface, but not inside any smaller one. So those are my two issues with the standard interpretation. But I think there's a lot to be learned from Mara. And so I want to sort of take what works well about the Mara and extract some lessons. And these are sort of lessons that are going to guide us. So what is Mara really doing that's useful? What makes Mara a powerful tool, at least in terms of someone who cares about holographic geometry? And so I think it's important to realize that Mara only is a good realization of the Ryu Takanagi procedure because the links cut are assumed to be uncorrelated. So when the links cut are uncorrelated, distances and cuts are both additive and locally measurable. So I think this is really the heart of the connection between tensor networks and geometry. If there were correlations between these different cuts we make along the Ryu Takanagi surface, we couldn't just count them. They wouldn't add. There would be cancellations amongst the distances. And so what I want to say is that what we're really saying, that the real consequence, is that the Ryu Takanagi surface in the tensor network encodes the compressed state of the interval. And so this is really what the tensor network is all about, as far as I'm concerned. It's all about compression. And so I want to elevate compression to a principle. It's not just a nice fact. It's really what we should be thinking about. So for my principles of tensor networks or gravitational states, I want to say that the whole raison d'etre of the tensor network is to encode compressed states along Ryu Takanagi surfaces. There's rule one. For rule two, I want to consider three contiguous regions on the boundary. So we have A, B, and C. So let's first look at the Routach Inagi surface for AB. That's this surface here. Want to look at the Routach Inagi surface for BC. That's this region here. The Routach Inagi surface for B. And the Routach Inagi surface for ABC. Oh, I added that one before, sorry. So those are those four Routach Inagi surfaces. And I want to take this sum, this signed sum of them. So you can see, actually, just by looking at the picture, since all lines are uncorrelated on these surfaces, we can just add and subtract them as we see fit, that there's only a few lines here that aren't canceled. We count one here positive, one here positive, one here positive, one here positive, and then we have two negative contributions. So probably to most of you, this sum is familiar. It's just the conditional mutual information. And so what we see is that the conditional mutual information of these regions is encoded locally in this region. And so information and correlations are really determined by local properties of the geometry, because the Routach at these compression surfaces sort of limit the ability of information to filter from different parts of the network to another part. And so this is my other sort of principle of tensor networks, is that conditional mutual information is encoded locally. So I'm going to take these principles now that we learned from Mara, and I'm going to see what I can do with them in terms of building tensor networks for more general states.
Actually, David, can you go back? I didn't understand principle one. What,
sure.
What is really like,
So, well, yeah, so can you...
Words, but, well, okay, what are these compressed states? What does that really mean?
So I'm saying that... The reason, so there's some small number of links here that cross this Routach Inagi surface, and some much larger. I mean, there's a much larger dimension of the Hilbert space for the actual UV state. And so we say the entropy is counted just by counting these lines. And so if we can just count these lines individually, what it's telling us about the density matrix here is that there's no correlations between these lines. So if there's correlations between these lines, that we'd have some smaller number. It wouldn't be given by the Routach Inagi entropy. And so the statement is that the fact that there's no correlations in this state is really saying that all that I've done in going from here to here is compress the state. That what the network has done in this region, what the isometries are doing, is removing mutual information between different subsystems. So we go from the state with lots of mutual information with itself to a state that has zero mutual information with itself. Is that great? Problem with animating your slides too much is then it takes a long time to get between them. So let's interpret, let's go back to our continuum picture, and let's try to put this together with our philosophy of what tensor networks are all about. So recall that the local geometric invariance of kinematic space can be written in terms of entanglement entropy, that this curvature was just the second derivative of the entanglement entropy. And so let's see what this density gives us when we integrate it over specific causal regions in kinematic space. So here's my cylinder of kinematic space. Here are some causal regions on the boundary, A, B, and C. And here is their sort of causal domain of dependence, future domain dependence. So if we look at this causal diamond up here at the top, what we see, and we integrate this density over it, it's kind of clear, it's just a second derivative. You just count its value at its corners. What you get is exactly the conditional mutual information. So what you should notice is that there's this marked region in kinematic space that's computing the conditional mutual information. And we have some marked region in our Mara lattice, which is doing the exact same thing. So I think it is maybe just a small leap, and I hope you'll follow me on this leap now, is that I want to suggest that we've been wrong all along, and that the Mara network is not a network that's describing discretized hyperbolic space. It's actually describing its discretized dual de Sitter space. So the things that we were calling Routach Inagi surfaces in the Mara, these lines here, should actually be understood as these red lines here in de Sitter space. And these are the causal domains of dependence of the appropriate boundary regions. And so the tensor nodes here that we're talking about is tensor nodes describing some sort of, you know, ADS size region in the spatial slice of ADS are really now points that are describing particular geodesics or particular boundary intervals in this other space. So is anyone objecting to this leap? Okay, good. So if we make that leap, it neatly resolves all of our lingering unhappiness with the standard model of Mera as hyperbolic space. It's very convenient that my only problems were the one I solved. Take of that what you will. But I think what we now see is, although, I mean, maybe in terms of the picture of just, you know, empty ADS and de Sitter, maybe you're happy to go either way. But while on the one hand, nobody really has a good picture of how to generalize the Mera network to describe arbitrary states, I do have kinematic space for things that are not just the ADS vacuum. So it seems actually now that if I go this other direction, I might have a powerful avenue to generalize my ideas. So what I want to do is use our principled approach to understanding what the Mera was all about and our knowledge of kinematic geometry. Is there some way that we can define efficient tensor networks for more general states? So in hindsight, let's take these principles and just change the words a little bit. So these are our new principles for tensor networks for general states. The tensor network should encode compressed states along the boundary of the domain of dependence of a boundary interval. And the purpose, So the purpose of the domain dependence is then to extract all of the mutual information a region has with its subsystems. That's what that part of the tensor network is all about. It's just an efficient network to remove mutual information. And the second principle now is conditional mutual information is encoded locally and is described by this curvature of kinematic space. So let's see how far we can go with just these two ideas. The requirement that our network performs compression along the future boundary interval is actually, I think, an extremely powerful idea. It's extremely limiting on how these networks are assembled. So correlations between our subsystems here, A and C, cannot be created by some part of the tensor network up here. Because if it was created up here, we'd find that there were correlations on this boundary of ABC. And that's not allowed. At the same time, they can't be created here, because this would put correlations along this boundary surface. So nor can they sort of propagate out acausally from the boundary of this interior region B. And so what we find is that the only place that a correlation between A and C are allowed to be placed in the network, that are allowed to be created, is in this top diamond. So all correlations between these two regions emerges here. And so we learn that information flows in a compression network along light rays. So the causal structure is really just telling us about information flow in this geometry or in this tensor network. So next, let's consider this colored region here of kinematic space. And you can just do this integral again. These are all light-like regions. It's just a second derivative, so you just count the corners. And what you find is that this region here computes the mutual information between the boundary region A and the boundary region B. So how can we make that work? Well, first, let's just remember that since these red borders, as we said, are compressed, mutual information between the regions A and B can only be created in this part of the network. That's what the causal structure dictates. So this is good. This density encodes mutual information, and we know it can't be created anywhere else. Everything's great. We also know that, as in Mera, the density integral must be equal to a boundary term. And the boundary term is just measuring the distance and the number of cuts along the bottom and the top. So if the cuts are correlated, these are just additive contributions to the entropy. And so we can solve this actually problem very easily. We can encode a network that performs these things in this region. And the way we do this is just to say that the curvature integral is really measuring the density of isometries that are inserting entangled bits into the network. So if I say that the curvature is just this, you know, the total number of isometries I insert here, we see that each isometry creates an entangled bit, an e-bit, between A and C. And at the same time, each entangled pair puts two lines on the bottom that aren't on the top. So the curvature has sort of told us exactly what we want to put in this region. And we can see this really, you know, in an arbitrarily small plaquette. So likewise, this region here that is the condition of mutual information, we know again that if all boundaries in our network are uncorrelated, then the conditional mutual information, as in the mirror, is just the difference between the number of cuts here and the number of cuts here. So we can, again, find out that the density integral that reproduces this is exactly the density of isometries inserting e-bits into the network. So I think we've sort of essentially solved the, at least how we insert correlations and how we insert mutual information to this network. We just read the curvature density as a density of insertions of entangled bits into the network. Is everyone happy with that piece of sort of that piece of building these networks? Okay. So for an arbitrary choice of entanglement entropies for boundary regions for any SUV that you like, we can use the corresponding curvature density to add lines to the network that prepare a state with exactly those entropies. So this is great. You know, whatever series of entropies you give me, I build a network, I just insert all these pairs in exactly the causal region that we're talking about, and I've built the network that prepares that state. Wonderful. There we go, that's our tensor network. Have we succeeded in reproducing the desired state with this tensor network? The answer is no, and I hope it should be clear why the answer is no. And that's because while we fixed the role of isometries, what we haven't actually fixed is the role of disentanglers in this network. So every time one of these lines cross, there's a possible interaction that mixes them. And so we see that this state, although it has all of the proper long-range correlation that we'd expect in our state, this correlation is actually very non-generic. Oh, sorry, I went too far. So it's not at all like the geometric states we're interested in, because this type of correlation that we build in this network says, you know, we entangle one local degree of freedom here with some, you know, local degree of freedom all the way over there. And that's not the type of entanglement that we get in geometric states. You know, geometric states, if there's entanglement between, you know, some region here and the region over there, the entanglement is sort of manifested in degrees of freedom whose length scale is, you know, corresponds to that actual distance between them. And so we know that we need to find some way of understanding the mixing in the network. We haven't actually built tensor networks for the arbitrary state yet. And so we need to spend some time understanding what the role of disentanglers are. So I want to sort of give you one piece of this puzzle, and that's sort of looking at as we take the UV state and build upward. So first what we do is we take two regions A and B that are next to each other and we compress them. So we get the compressed state with fewer degrees of freedom on their sort of future causal boundary. What we need to be able to do, actually, if this network does what we say it does, is we need to be able to iterate the compression procedure. So we need to be able to perform another operation. You can't quite see it. Anyways, there's another triangle here that fills us in. So we have some compression along this surface now. In order for this to be possible, what we need is that all the mutual information between A and B was fed into these internal lines, and that there was no remaining mutual information between sites 1 and 2, because nothing we did in this future compression step affected site 1 or site 2. So how do we build a tensor network that does that? That doesn't seem very obvious. How do I do something locally here so I know that, you know, as I do things farther in the future, that I've removed and directed all the information where it needs to go? So what we see is that the role of the disentanglers is really kind of the traffic cop in these networks, that they're really directing mutual information to the proper place. And so this characteristic of the network that I said in the last slide can be achieved by sort of two simple rules. And the simple rule is just that along any fixed U light ray, that the degrees of freedom that live there only have mutual information with things to their left, and that degrees of freedom that live on any fixed V light ray have only mutual information with things to their right. And so this is really the role of what disentanglers are doing, at least read from the bottom up, that we take some system left A, B, right, and that we take all of the mutual information that A, B has with their left, and we put it in A prime, and we take all the mutual information that A, B have with the right, and we put it in B primed. So this is what allows us to achieve this property of the network that's seen constructing from the bottom up, that information is moving along causal rays to the left or right. Correspondingly, we can kind of look at the role of disentanglers from the top down. So it's clear that disentanglers, which are now actually entanglers read the other way, they're distributing information across the interior of the light cone. And this is exactly the property we needed, right? With the network without disentanglers just had sort of long range but local correlation. And what a disentangler does is that when information is coming down here, it's spread into these two legs, and then this comes through and it's spread into these three. And so, you know, entanglers then are just spreading the information out along the light cone. So I want to just make one note is that this mixing is not at all generic. So these are very special operations that we actually build into our network. So if this was sort of, if the role of these combined disentanglers was to create some generic unitary transformation, as soon as too many lines crossed, you'd find the information was found in here because this Hilbert space in the interior is sort of much larger than this one here. And so what that would end up doing was just, it would shunt the information not along the light cone, it would sort of bury it back into some smaller region. So you need a very special type of mixing that doesn't have this property. Otherwise, we would violate our compression requirement. So thus far, these two slides about compression, about the role of disentanglers have been, I think, a little bit aspirational. And so what we'd like to do is use the data of the CFT to precisely fix the action of these disentanglers. And in order to do this, I want to note that non-local mixing we've been describing is precisely what's measured by tripartite information. So tripartite information is really just the difference between the mutual information that some system AB has with another system C and the mutual information that's just had in its parts alone, you know, the mutual information of B and C and the mutual information of A and C. So this is what tripartite information is all about. So we need this higher measure of information in order to fix the disentanglers. So we can't use just conditional mutual information for these contiguous regions or just the entanglement entropy of single regions alone in order to completely determine our MARA network. So let's talk about tripartite information. Before I get into the heart of disentanglers, I want to say, I think this is the most appropriate time to make a little aside. So there's another way that you can rewrite tripartite information. And so in terms of region A here and C, and the region in between them B, we can talk, so the tripartite information is just the difference in the mutual information that A and C have, and the conditional mutual information, which is encoded in this part of the lattice. You'll notice that since all mutual information between A and C must arise from this purple region of our network, and that tells us exactly just the conditional mutual information, we have a very interesting restriction, is that these types of networks can only create states that have tripartite information that is negative. This is always an upper bound on the mutual information. So this is not generic, but rather a restriction on the types of states that we can build with compression networks. So negative tripartite information is a necessary condition to have a geometric bulk dual, but it's certainly not, and it's certainly not a sufficient condition. And so what I want to say actually is that our tensor networks can construct what I want to label as quasi-gravitational states. So I can't build a compression network like this for any state you give me, but that's just fine. I mean, we're really interested about quantum gravity. And so I think it's very interesting to talk about geometric states and states that are nearly geometric. So about, you know, some class of non-geometric perturbations about geometric states. And so these perturbations are not necessarily small in some typical perturbative gravity sense. They're real non-geometric perturbations of this state. And so by studying these networks, we really do have a wide class of interesting sort of quasi-geometric states for quantum gravity. Okay, so now let's get back to the main story. So to understand the relationship between disentanglers and tripartite information, it'll be useful to examine the behavior in a state with a geometric dual. So let's start with things that we think we know. And so let's consider three contiguous regions again. This little triangle is kind of the heart of everything. Everything can be learned by looking at these. We want to work in the regime where A and C have non-zero mutual information. And the thing that's very special about gravitational states is that in that case, that the entropy of the union of A and C is just given by the entropy of B and the entropy of ABC. So this is not typical of any state. This is something particular about gravitational states. So some basic algebra then gives us, if we just use this, is that the tripartite information is actually minus the conditional entropy of B on A minus the conditional entropy of B and C. And we can translate that into some particular region of integrated curvature on our network. What region is that? Well, it's just these infinite wings, these wings that go out to the end of our network that propagate from these regions here. So tripartite information in a geometric state is measured by some very simple region of the network. So the integrated curvature in this region, going all the way up, is measuring all of the insertions of correlated e-bits into the network until we've completely removed all correlation. So we can see that it's a dual to measuring twice the number of lines here and twice the number of lines here. And so if twice the number of lines along these edges is the difference between the conditional mutual information and the mutual information, what it's telling us is that each line that crosses destroys exactly one e-bit of mutual information. So how can we do this? Well, let's just imagine just a simple toy model. So we start with some entangled pair. And now we insert another entangled pair. So we have this state of IIJJ. And now we perform this mixing operation. And this mixing operation just sends I to I plus J and J to I plus 2J, where we're counting all, where addition is all done mod n. So if you look at the state, what's actually very nice, this is a particular code where if you look at this system, it has no correlation with either I or J, and this system has either no correlation alone with either I or J, and you need both of them together. So this mixing has completely distributed the correlations with both I and J into their joint system. So this, you can see at step one, we've destroyed the correlations here. So each line that crosses destroys one e-bit. So that's perfect. This does exactly what we want. What you might be worried about is this type of operation as we repeat as more lines cross, that somehow we siphon off the information into this interior region. But it's not true. So we can repeat this procedure. We add some other k. We do the exact same operation. But there's no correlation that's siphoned off. And you can actually sort of easily see is that, if you have one of these, I and j, it's uncorrelated with I or j because I plus j and I is sort of an independent quantity. You have two variables, and if you have I plus j, you need both I and j to determine them. You're always missing one. And so every time we insert another correlated pair, we insert another random variable. And so the number of shares, the number of pieces of the system you need actually increases with each step. So you need not just these two interior ones, but you need something in the exterior in order to get back the information. So this is great. This simple toy model encodes the exact type of behavior we want. We see that information does not flow into the causally prohibited region. And I think this is a very interesting class of codes to study. And there's, I think, very obvious connections with recent work understanding space-time and quantum error-correcting codes and quantum secret sharing that's been in recent work of Almhiri et al. So I think this is maybe a very precise manifestation of what they're thinking about. So what I would say then is that gravitational states are thus seen to be these sort of maximally mixing, and that every pair of crossing lines must distribute the information equally amongst themselves, as our toy model did. And so in doing so, every line sort of destroys exactly the maximal and possible amount of mutual information. So what we do want to quantify, though, is how far away our disentanglers are away from this gravitational state in something more generic. So how far away they are from this maximally mixing behavior. So to do this, consider one last time the gravitational state. So let's look in this very particular example. So let's take the interior region B to be u just plus some tiny amount, and C is the interval from u to v. So that means that the top of their causal cone is really at the point in the network uv. And so note that we are in this region where the entropy of A and C is given by this other surface, B and ABC. We're past the phase transition region because we've made this sort of arbitrarily small. And so what we can ask now, what happens when I take this endpoint v and move it out a little bit? Well, we see is that in the gravitational state, that the length of just this wing here changes by this little plaquette. But this little plaquette, remember, was just the conditional mutual information at UV. So what we learn is that in the gravitational state, there's this very peculiar relation that the derivative with respect to V of I3 is just given by this curvature density. So, what I'd like to say is that what I want to include in a general state, we define two different metric curvature structures. We define a metric and curvature structure, which I'll label with a 3, that is given by this derivative of the tripartite information. And I give a second structure that's given, just as we said before, by the conditional mutual information. And so the condition that our state has a good geometric dual is that these two densities are identical. So in that case, we can count the insertion of lines into our network in sort of two equivalent ways. Every line creates information and every line destroys information. So there's sort of egalitarianism of these two points of views, but that's not at all generic. And so the difference of these curvatures is really a measure of the failure of our quasi-geometric CFD state to have a true geometric dual. And so it sort of measures how far away this state is from being geometric. And so I think this curvature here fixes the role of isometries, this curvature here fixes the role of entanglers, and we have a formalism that is able to talk about non-geometric perturbations to geometric states. And so I think this is a very powerful tool for doing quantum gravity. So what have we seen in this section, because it was a little long? Well, we demonstrated that there are explicit method for constructing tensor networks for quasi-geometric boundary states. The density of isometries in this network is determined by some curvature, which is determined by conditional mutual information. The delocalization of information by entanglers is determined by another curvature, which is measured by tripartite information. And for geometric states, these curvature densities are identical and precisely the curvature forms that we associate with the kinematic space of the dual geometry. So what are some implications of this, since I'm nearly out of time? Well, already this sort of allows you to distinguish some classes of states that we know to be geometric and that we know not to be geometric. So our tripartite information can look at n copies of a CFT and differentiate it from the orbifold state. So for n copies, to prepare n copies of a CFT, you take the tensor network that prepares one copy, and you just take 10 of them, or n of them. So what's very sort of unnatural about this n copies that you see is that the red lines interact with red lines and blue lines with blue lines, but they all cross the other colored lines and don't interact at all. And so what this will inevitably happen is that there's a factor of n difference in these two curvature forms. That it does not mix nearly strongly enough because it passes through all but one of the n lines without any interaction happening. But in the symmetric orbifold theory, the lines become sufficiently mixed by the gauge identification, and so you have this property that these two will agree again. There's also interesting things we can learn about smooth IR geometries versus singularity. So our construction of the tensor network depended on our ability to cleanly direct the information either to the left or right. And so you might be wondering, we're on a circle, clearly at large distances, there's going to be some failure of left and right to be distinguishable. Well, that's exactly true. So exactly when the half angle of the interval gets to pi over 2, we have this failure to be able to distinguish left and right because here is one boundary and there's some correlations created in the network above alpha over pi over 2 that would kind of correlate the left and the right. So there'd be some failure. So how on earth do we build this top part of the network? Surprisingly, there's no problem, and that's because we don't have to build the top part of the network. So we know from differential entropy that the length of a curve that circles the origin, so some point, is going to 0. And so it follows, actually, that there are no lines that cross this part of the network. So it must follow, actually, that we've removed all the mutual information already by the time we get to alpha equals pi over 2. And so this top part of the network is just kind of an identified copy of the bottom half of the network. And there's no new correlations that are built by this part. So we conclude for smooth geometry, all mutual information is removed, and the network is complete right here. But conversely, if we build the tensor network all the way to pi over 2, and there still remains mutual information, we are nevertheless actually unable to compress further using these tools. So we can't actually just go farther and remove that extra information. And so we are left with some non-trivial density matrix in the IR. So this density matrix could be understood to be the failure of the IR spacetime to be smooth. But I should note, although we could take this opinion, we should give the caveat that we're actually unable to reconstruct the geometry, not sort of up to some singularity, but actually this failure will happen far away from the singularity in the geometry. So it's actually in a region where we probably expect there still to be some good geometric description. And so I'd like to say just perhaps this is actually suggestive that we need to supplement our information theoretic procedures with sort of additional probes. So entanglement entropy is encoded by minimal geodesics. Lots of spacetimes have other geodesics that are not minimal. And these are necessary to reconstruct the entire tangent space. And we need sort of some understanding of what they are in the field theory. So this is sort of the question, what is entwinement, as these long geodesics have been labeled by one of my collaborators and his collaborators. Two more things, and then I promise I'm done, so don't fret. There's a beautiful picture of kinematic space in the holographic RG. I can't tell you very much about it right now, so let me be very quick. So it's natural to ask what the real space holographic RG looks like in kinematic space. So we can do a real space RG where we take the boundary here and we move it in a little bit. So it's not just as simple as removing, you might expect, just kind of cutting off the top and bottom of our kinematic space, or say, like, you know, removing part of the tensor network near the boundary. So why is that? Well, remember that kinematic space is telling us about how we reconstruct the lengths of lines. And when we move the boundary in, the length of this line changes. Right? It loses this piece. But it loses it because it loses intersections with two types of geodesics. These geodesics, which are the things we move near the boundary, but there's also these long geodesics that are not at all about the boundary. So to understand what's happening, we can see what's it's good to look at what's happening to the geodesics themselves under this RG flow. So let's take these two geodesics. These two geodesics were light-like separated. But when we do the RG, we look on the new boundary that these two geodesics now are actually time-like separated. So we actually have to see that there is a change in the causal structure under RG flow. And so we should understand that the RG flow can also be seen as a flow on the causal structure of the dual space. So you can imagine some point here that corresponds to a curve in dual space. It's something that this curve actually sort of left some region. There's some point here in the interior, which would correspond to one of these curves here. And there's some point that lies exactly on the boundary, and it corresponds to this curve here. And so two geodesics that meet at this point should now be thought of as light-like. And so what it's saying is that the curve that corresponded to this point should now be like a new light cone in this geometry. And so that's what the RG flow is doing in this dual space. And there's a lot more that one can say about that, but I won't now. So for the condensed matter theorists, I just want to say that efficiently finding approximate ground states sort of for non-conformal field theory or finding excited states is actually an enormously difficult problem. So these are not efficiently encoded necessarily by a mirror network. And searching over the space of all non-mirror network skeletons would be an enormously difficult problem. You know, you have to search over all possible configurations of some tensor network. Certainly, that would be one way to do it. And so I think what we can say about what we've done for a condensed matter theorist is that our network greatly simplifies this variational problem, for quasi-geometric states at least, because we fixed the network skeleton. So what we believe, and we have not proven, is that you can take our network skeleton and you don't need to make the tensors very large. That this network skeleton has already been chosen to be efficient. And so you just have to vary over the precise unitaries at each node. And so this, I think, it should be seen as an enormous reduction in the computational problem of finding these states. I can't prove that. That's just words. But I hope this picture seems like makes that sort of, if not convincing, then at least intriguing. And the last thing I want to say is about the Bianchi-Myers conjecture. So recall one of our aims was to better understand what holographic entropy is counting. And so I want to look at sort of two pictures. I want to consider some region A and some region B. They have almost the same boundary, but region B has this red spike cut into the boundary, right? So its boundary has been lengthened. And so the typical picture, if we assume entropy to area, is that this spike should give some sort of increase to the entropy of region B. So this makes sense from a perturbative perspective, where the leading contribution to the entropy is, you know, it's considered to be UV bulk degrees of freedom near the boundary. And so every time we increase the area, we obviously increase the entanglement between UV degrees of freedom along that area. And so that seems to be perfectly consistent. What I'd like to tell you is that I think the non-perturbative perspective fails and that there's really a different picture that we get from quantum gravity. And we can see that already at the level of the mirror. I think mirror sees this counting very differently. So let's take this region and let's add a spike to it. In order to do that, I just want to kind of blow it up and linearize the picture. So adding a spike to this should be seen locally as taking this cut here and then sort of jagging inward like this. So what did this spike do to the entropy? So let's blow up again. Here is some small region of that spike. Well, what we immediately see from the Mara network is that not all contributions to the length can be counted positively towards the entropy. Some actually must be seen as constraints. So why is this? Well, let's say we count this length here positively and this length positively, and let's keep going. Well, all of a sudden we realize that this line here is an input to the same node. And so we can't count it positively. This line actually represents a constraint. You know, the choice of the state here should be seen as a projection on the state here. And so we can't count all links positively to entropies. There are, you know, so we can some links sort of count the Hilbert space. And so naturally, links along the cut correspond to constraints on that Hilbert space. And that's very natural. There's no reason that specifying the geometry in some interior region somehow gives us more states. It's really like a further condition on what the geometry looks like in the interior of that region. So how do we see this in the Mara? Well, the interesting, oh, you can't. Sorry, some things on my computer that are visible here aren't. There's a shaded region here that is the causal cone of these links that we've cut here. And so the point is that this line crosses the causal cone of the sites that are already cut. So every time you cross the causal cone of a site you've cut, now you're counting negative constraints and not positive lengths. And what's beautiful is that this is exactly the behavior that's encoded by kinematic space. So only certain regions of kinematic space analogous to the Mara causal cuts correspond to everywhere positive length in real space. In general, some cuts of kinematic space correspond to positive contributions to the Hilbert space of IR states, and some correspond to negative constraints on this space. So recall, this is just as a picture here where we said, this is always positive, but a generic lump of kinematic space is something positive and something negative. And so we can say the same thing about the states and tensor networks we get in general, that, you know, generic pieces of them correspond to, you know, signed areas. And so I think Mara and the more general kinematic space agree on a refined space-time entanglement picture that is fundamentally different from the perturbative picture, that the entropy we should assign to a region of space-time is not its area, as we sort of guessed from black hole thermodynamics, but it's a signed area. And the right way we compute the signs is by looking at kinematic space. And it's exactly the, you know, the coarse-grained version of that we just see in how we cut nodes in the tensor network that builds kinematic space. So now I'm done. I'm sorry I've gone over. Just to briefly say what we've done, maybe I'll just put these up there because I've already taken all your time. I'll leave these here. I've taken your time. You're free to read them on your as you sit there. So thank you very much. That's not so much the, well, that's not like a definition. It's really, if you assume that all of these lines are compressed surfaces, then they just compute entropy, and it's necessary then, just by, you know, adding and subtracting the entropies, that you get condition mutual information is given by that difference. That sort of, it follows from our principles. So that wasn't an added assumption.
So it's in part of your discussion, or starting point of your discussion, was that raw infrared, as you drew it there, did not have correlation between the different indices.
Yes.
Is that an approximate statement?
Yeah, these are always approximate statements, definitely. I think that's part of
it. There are many correlations, and they are not accidental. I mean, you can argue that if this is describing a CFT, then in the direction of this curve, the scaling dimensions of the CFT will translate into masses that correlate these indices non-trivially.
I mean, so what we have done is we removed the vast majority of mutual information, and that's the statement that these can be counted additively, right? If they couldn't.
They can be counted additively, but that doesn't mean that there are no correlations between them. Actually, there are significant correlations between them. We've been trying to take the raw infrared and break it into pieces, and that would be a gross approximation.
Okay, I mean, it's certainly it's subleading in the sense that we can count these as additive contributions, right?
That was my question, actually.
Okay.
So you're saying that the contributions kind of, that the total entropy sum is proportional to the number of indices.
Yes. Okay, yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And that should be understood as a statement that we've removed most of the mutual information of that region, right? It has a much larger dimension Hilbert space. It has lots of mutual information. There's enormous amounts of correlation here. I mean, and I'm always thinking large N here, and so maybe this is why this is certainly relevant here. And so at large N, there's enormous amounts of correlation here, and there's much less here. And so that is what this network is doing, is it's approximately removing all of the mutual information.
So the mirror is supposed to be geometrically a Lorentzian de Sitter, right?
Yes.
So a region of the mirror is a space-time-ish region, not the region of space.
Yes.
Then what were we doing in the last part applying the Bianchi-Myers conjecture?
Oh, so the point was is that we want a region, well, so if we took some region of the dual space, we can find the number of states we can get by, you know, rebuilding this part of the network. And that's some number of states. And that number of states is counted by this space-time area. But the statement was, in general, that if I take the number of states I can get by rebuilding this region of this network, it's not given by a space-time area, it's given by assigned space-time area. Assigned real space area. And so if you had looked at this, if you just sort of taken some generic cut, my statement was that, you know, if you thought the mirror was encoding real space, you might think you could just kind of cut it arbitrarily, that gives you an area, and that's an entropy, and that's sort of the wrong picture. I want to assign that the natural way to understand this non-convex real space area is that we have to count things positively and negatively. So if I wanted to say, this single counted region of dual space gives me negative and positive, you might ask, what can I do to make this positive? Well, if you make that positive, it's non-convex, and so the region you get here is a double counting. And so now I don't have a good interpretation of how to talk about a state that's talking about now, because I've taken pieces of the network twice. And so what I would want to say is the only way you can talk about really just a state is by taking a convex area in real space and some union of point curves in dual space.
So the point is that this is just another way to see that you must think of the mirror as a Lorentzian geometry.
Yes.
Otherwise, the entanglement conjecture doesn't make
sense. Yeah, and I think it's really important. That we really should not think about an entropy assigned to areas in space, in real space. And I think that's what perturbation theory suggests is true, and this suggests that fails. And so I think there's some very interesting things that could be learned by understanding how this breaks down. Because, I mean, the whole black hole information paradox is looking at the entanglement of pairs created near the horizon, but looking at UV entanglement of these modes. And this is saying that picture is fundamentally wrong for understanding space-time entanglement. That, you know, really, that although that's fine at low energies, if we try to do that all the way up to high energies, we get completely the wrong answer. And this is the right answer. And so we need to understand how to do this for black holes and not really talk about Hawking pairs.
Okay.